From the studios of WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. The United Nations Climate Change Summit is underway in Paris, and for the first time in years, world leaders are hopeful a global agreement is possible. Without organized cooperation, NASA scientists say the Earth will see an escalation of catastrophic weather events, such as longer and more intense heat waves, more severe storms, flooding, sea level rise, the list goes on, impacting everything from human health to food production. The Charlotte Observer recently sponsored a forum called America's Water, An Uncertain Future, hosted by Science Friday's Ira Flatow. At the Tuesday night event, a senior water scientist from NASA explained why water scarcity is not just a Southwestern problem. The Southeast is already seeing its water supply dwindle. Joel Bourne is a journalist and science writer with a degree in agronomy from NC State. He says he once imagined he would follow his grandfather to the fields as a farmer, but the call of journalism proved stronger. He reported for National Geographic and served as senior editor on the environment there. He's also written for Audubon and Science. His new book, The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World, chosen by the Financial Times of London as one of the best books of 2015, warns that if current trends continue, the world will need to grow nearly twice the amount of food that we currently produce by the year 2050 in order to stave off widespread hunger, misery, violence, and ecological destruction. Today, we'll learn why Bourne says there's an impending food crisis, which experimental food production methods look promising, and what we can do to change that trajectory. Joel Bourne, welcome to Coastline.
Rachel, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. If you have a question, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org or tweet us using coastlinehqr. Joel Bourne, what are the food sources, the crops, that are largely responsible for sustaining the global population?
Well, this is one of the interesting things I found out when I was researching the book, that even though we have thousands of edible crops available to us on the planet, only three, wheat, rice, and corn, or maize as it's called elsewhere in the world, provide the bulk of all the calories that humans consume. They're either eaten directly, like rice, which provides almost half the world with its calories, or indirectly, like corn, which is used as livestock feed for cattle and chickens and hogs, which is largely how we consume it in the developed world. So upon these three crops hang all the stomachs of the world, oddly enough, and it's been that way for quite some time.
And what is happening in terms of crop production and the world population? Why is this becoming a trajectory that isn't going to work out very well in a few years?
Well, one of the things that we've seen, basically it started around the turn of the century, around 2000, is that this dramatic yield growth that we had seen in these three crops since about, started in the 1960s and is loosely termed the Green Revolution. We had seen just progressively increasing yields, and this is the amount of crops we can grow per acre of land or hectare, up until pretty much the mid-90s. And then right around 2000, we saw these yields start to plateau. And since then, we've seen almost no growth in either of these crops. We still see a little bit of growth in corn because there's a lot of money investment going into corn. But for wheat and rice, which are two of the most important crops on the planet, their yields have basically flatlined. Meanwhile, now why this is important is because up until now, the yields have basically tracked with population growth. So as population continues to grow 1.8, 2% a year, you know, we'd get a 1.5, 2% increase in yield growth. And that kind of kept everybody happy. But what's happened, of course, now is that these yields have plateaued while population growth continues to rise. And that puts a real kink in the supply and demand ratio.
And what has contributed, in broad brushstrokes here, because this is what the book is about, but broad brushstrokes, what has contributed to the plateau in those crop yields?
You know, it's really interesting. It's kind of we took our eye off the ball, if you want to put it in simple terms. Basically, the Green Revolution started in about 1945. Some of your listeners may remember Norman Borlaug, the great geneticist who came up with these new varieties of wheat that were just outstanding yield producers, but they required a lot of water, a lot of chemical fertilizers, a lot of pesticides to protect them. Borlaug was so successful. I mean, think about this. His primary crop was wheat, and it took 1,000 years for farmers to quadruple the yield of wheat up until Borlaug's time. It took him 40 to triple it from there. So, I mean, his techniques, I mean, it was the greatest increase in agricultural production the world had ever seen. And we thought we had solved the food crisis. In fact, he created so many, such an incredible volume of crops that food prices hit the floor during the 1980s when I graduated from NC State, and farmers were going bankrupt all over the place.
And since you've referenced the Green Revolution and Norman Borlaug, he won a Nobel Prize for his particular version of wheat that was rust-resistant.
Rust-resistant and high-yielding, but it wasn't – honestly, he won the Nobel Peace Prize, which was – he didn't win a prize in science or in agriculture. He won it for peace because of this system that he – and, of course, he was not alone. There were many people working on this – because of the system of agriculture he developed that we termed scientific agriculture when I was at NC State, he made food prices lower around the world, decreased poverty around the world. We basically went from having 30% of the world's population hungry, just not able to get enough food to eat in the 1940s and 50s, to 12% today. It was a tremendous increase. But even Borlaug said in 1970, what I have done, what we have done with the Green Revolution is going to give us about 30 years of breathing room. And if we do not get population under control, he called it the population monster, then we're going to be right back where we started in 30 years. And sure enough, in 2000, almost on the spot, yield growth stopped growing, population continued to rise, and suddenly we had this incredible run-up in prices that we saw in 2007 and 2008.
So that was not a hysterical prediction. He was right on the money.
He was right on the money.
Production dropping off.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, population growth, you referenced that being an issue, and in your book, you go back to the 18th century, Robert Malthus. Can you tell us what he initially said about food supply, population growth, and why that was such a controversial issue?
Sure. I learned basically like all school kids growing up, I learned Malthus was the original nattering nabob of negativity, right? He was this Anglican minister in England who was also a math whiz at Cambridge. And he came up with a sort of formula that basically, since population can expand exponentially, and agriculture, he felt, could only expand arithmetically, then anyone with any sort of familiarity with those two concepts would know that if population wasn't checked by some means, that within 100 years, there would be twice as many people in England as there would be food for them to grow. So he was sort of the original limits to growth guy. Like, there is always going to be checks on population. Now, but what Malthus didn't realize and what people criticized him was he did not foresee this great run-up in agricultural production that allowed this enormous population that came after Malthus to survive. He didn't see the Industrial Revolution. You know, before, Malthus was dealing with an economy that was based on basically wood, sunshine, the products of the forest and of the field. Afterwards, economies became based on coal and the inherent energy and thousands of years of photosynthesis wrapped up in hydrocarbons. He missed that, as did most classical economists. But the pressures on population have never gone away. And so that's when I started writing this and I interviewed some Malthus experts. They said, Malthus is usually criticized because he advocated against the poor laws. He was highly criticized for that. But if you actually read him, he didn't say the world was going to basically collapse after some huge run-up in population. Basically, he said there are always going to be pressures, whether it's wages, whether it's food, whether it's disease, that are always going to be keeping population from outrunning subsistence. And, of course, food is one of the major problems there.
Was he an advocate for controlling the population in some way?
Well, the only thing he he could not bring himself to advocate condoms and prophylactics like that, being a preacher. But his big thing was moral restraint. He was the first abstinence-only guy. And but his argument, I thought, was well taken, because he basically said people shouldn't have children they can't support. And the poor laws at that time paid men for every child that they had in order to make sure that the children were fed. However, Borlaug, we lay the blame on welfare moms, the classic thing, whereas Borlaug laid the blame on men, 100%. Men should not have children that they can't feed. Men should wait to marry until they can support a family. It's the man's responsibility. So it was all men, men, men. And somehow we've lost that message over the years.
And in your book, you do get into the importance of gender equality in terms of changing this trajectory and how important that is. Just a minute or so before we go to break, but your reporting for National Geographic is what sort of led you to this book. You were reporting on disparate stories, or seemingly disparate anyway, all over the world. And then one day it sort of, probably not in a day, but coalesced for you and you went, this is a thing. Can you tell us about some of those assignments?
Sure. I began working for the Geographic in 2000 and had been on staff for about 7 or 8 years. And over that time, I'd report on the drought in California, which I talked to several farmers out there. I'd record on the report on the big biofuel rush that came on around 2005, when suddenly everybody was crazy about biofuel. I did several stories about climate change and the impacts. And all of this coalesced around the idea that the big environmental story of my generation is going to be food and agriculture and the impacts on the world.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking with writer Joel Bourne about his book, The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. If you have a question or a comment, you can give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. This is Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn, and with me in the studio, Joel Bourne, contributor to National Geographic and author of the book, The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. If you'd like to ask Joel Bourne a question, give us a call at 910-343-1138 or send us an email at coastline@whqr.org. Joel Bourne, we said at the beginning of the show that 2050 is sort of the magic year that the world's population and our ability to produce food will create a food crisis around the globe. Why 2050? That, at the risk of being Captain Obvious here, that's only 35 years away.
Originally, when this was not my deadline, this was something that the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization were looking at. And it came from a report that they did that basically looked out 50 years. It came out around the turn of the century. And at that point, population, the UN median projections for population had us hitting 9 billion in 2050 and then starting to slowly decline. So that was why 2050 was the crunch point. As long as we can feed everybody adequately by 2050, after that population goes down, we're in the breeze.
And why is population predicted to decline at that point?
Well, fertility rates, the number of children a woman has during her lifetime, have been declining steadily since about the 1960s. And so based on those and based on, basic projecting out, the UN is actually pretty good about estimating world population. They've gotten it very good since they've started tracking it in about 1940s, early 1950s. And their median projection is usually the most accurate. So they have these low projection, high projection, and one in the middle. But what happened over the last few years, which is most concerning, is that the fertility rates have stubbornly refused to fall in many countries in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. So they just recently this summer increased their projections for population. So now, according to their plans and their estimates, we're going to hit 9.6 billion at 2050 and keep on growing to almost 11 billion by 2100. Now, here's where the numbers get really important. now that we're all in Paris talking about climate change. A few years ago, the Royal Society came out with sort of this broad study looking at climate change impacts on our ability to grow food. And they projected that if we get to a 4 degree centigrade increase in global average surface temperatures, which is right where we're headed based on our current emissions, half of our current agricultural land, 2 billion hectares around the world, may be either less suited or even unsuitable for food production by the end of the century. And that's when population is going to hit 11 billion people. So how do you feed 4 billion more people on the planet with half the agricultural land?
And
it just doesn't add up.
So climate change, one of the contributing factors to making food production more difficult. In the Southeast, we see storms, we see more flooding, we see lots of rain. Why, it's not counterintuitive, but some people could argue, isn't that going to help with the water supply issue?
Well, if you ask farmers, flooding is just as bad as drought. And I think you'll see that in many parts of the world where floods have taken out massive amounts of crops. By and large, some regions will benefit. And that was the critical thing. People used to say, wow, plants like carbon. They love CO2. We're going to see these massive yields when we live in a CO2-rich environment. But when they actually took the plants, took corn, wheat, rice, and ran them in field trials with highly enriched CO2 atmospheres, they found like the temperature increases are so great, we didn't see any yield gain at all. We actually saw negative yield because things were getting hotter. So plants, in order for them to thrive, need a lot of things, not just water. They need daylight that comes on and off at certain hours, and they need water, and they need temperature for sure. And one of the great critical things we're looking at is in some of the great bread baskets of the world, where there a lot of these are irrigated bread baskets like the U.S. Midwest, the North China Plain, and in India in the Punjab region, we're seeing aquifers decline at an unbelievable rate, which puts their agriculture at risk. We're also seeing temperatures reach what is currently sort of the top level for wheat production in many of these parts of the world. So if it goes above, and this is we're talking nighttime temperature is the real important thing for wheat. If it gets higher than wheat can withstand, suddenly what happens when, you know, the Punjab can't grow wheat for India anymore or the North China Plain can't grow wheat for China? These are the things that that send the ag researchers in the world, in fits of nervousness and anxiety.
And what causes aquifers to decline?
Well, part of the Green Revolution that is probably the least talked about part. We all talk about the chemicals and the high-yielding seeds and the fertilizers. None of that works without irrigation. None of that works without water. So the fourth component of the system, Ms. Borlaug called it, was irrigated agriculture. So, and that was subsidized back in the 1960s. There were these big federal programs that were done in India and China and the United States where we subsidized agricultural irrigation. And we did it to such an extent. The World Bank is one of the biggest funders of these type of programs that we've overdrawn many of these aquifers in some of the breadbaskets around the world. So what we're now looking at is I think the NASA satellites that fly around, the GRACE satellites that look at mass of the Earth, the withdrawal of the water beneath the North India Bangladesh plain is the second highest loss of Earth's mass after the melting of the Greenland and the Antarctic ice sheets. So we're looking at a massive amount of water, something like 4 to 5 times the size of Lake Mead over the last 5 years being lost in that aquifer that's not going to be replaced on any time scale that is going to matter to us or to them. So it's an incredibly important issue.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with writer Joel Bourne about his new book, The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. If you have a question, you can give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Don, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Yes, I have a question about food distribution, but let me say it's going to end with a political question. The amount of food that's lost through distributions, transport around the world, I suppose you know the exact figure or heard a figure anyway, that would be close.
Oh, I have, Don. Great question and a very important one. We currently grow enough food to feed 9 billion people, a fairly healthy 2,000-calorie, you know, a day diet. And we have for many years. The problem is most of that food is produced in places that don't need it, like the United States and Canada and Australia. And it's not produced in places that need it, like sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. And transporting that food to those areas is extremely costly. So when I was at NC State, you know, it was during the Earl Butz era where the American farmer was going to plant fence row to fence row and feed the world. And what we found out by overproduction was that the world could not afford to feed itself, sadly enough. And we've seen that happen in many parts of the world. Haiti, I've got an example in the book about Haiti, where we went in, completely wiped out Haiti's rice production and, you know, dropped their tariffs on imported rice and flooded them with rice from Arkansas. This was under the Clinton era. And when the price, then, you know, suddenly the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere is forced to buy rice on the international market. So when the price of rice goes up fivefold like it did in 2007, you saw riots. You saw the Haitian government fall. So the concept is really to help these countries that are having the most difficult time with food security grow more of their own food. It's a food security issue. It's a national security issue. And in many cases, it can be done because there's these huge yield gaps with what they're producing and what they're producing elsewhere in the world. Now, the food waste issue is another one that's key. 30% of all the food we grow, including all the embodied water, all the embodied energy, just gets lost, just gets wasted along the food line. Here in the developed country, we eat too much, we scrape too much off the plate. It's past the farm gate, right? It's the consumer that's the issue. In the developing world, it's where they don't have good grain bins, they don't have dryers, they don't have good ways to store crops. It's pre-farm gate. They're losing it in the field before it ever gets to market. And both of these are critical issues that we need to resolve in order to make more food available. I mean, in some cases with meat and vegetables, it's been estimated that half of all of those are lost simply due to the waste. And that's just unsustainable.
Go
ahead, Don.
You got into the political part much quicker than I would have. But everything you mentioned is a question of political economic choices and how we choose it. And we've been trying to do it as from a top-down model. Not only with the farming, but with politics, in that we're trying to unify the world in terms of food security. And any government is not going to last a day if people aren't fed. That is the thing that will drive everybody to the street, no doubt. And trying to make everybody resistant to the Malthusian dictates around the world when some countries are and some countries aren't. And as you said, we most certainly are very resistant to it. We're blessed. Many other countries are cursed.
Yeah, but you know, I think you're exactly right.
There are propped up governments that have not been able to feed their people. Well, we fed their people for them. And so they haven't been very good governments either.
No, Don, you're exactly right. And here's one of the things I talk about in the book. There are two things. Most of the challenges we face are not scientific. They are political and they're cultural. And what you see going on in Paris right now is a political issue dealing with a scientific thing. Part of it is cultural. You know, we can reduce the amount of children, or the fertility rates that these women in these countries have by liberating them with what I've called a pink revolution in the book, educating women to at least the seventh grade, empowering them, giving them jobs, making it so that their life is not one of servitude and motherhood from the time they're 10 years old. These are things we can do and will do that will have enormous benefits both there and elsewhere in the world. And of course, you're absolutely right about these dictators in many parts of the world that take money from foreign governments and do not spread the wealth to their local populations. And this is hopefully this is changing. I think democracy is coming to many of these countries. It's slow to happen, but I think it's coming. And I'm a huge proponent of Africa. I love the continent. I think it's got a lot of promise and potential.
Don, thanks so much for your call. And going back to the notion that so many of these decisions are based in politics, the Climate Change Summit, as you said, is going on now in Paris. In your travels around this country and around the world, when you talk to agronomists and farmers and the people who are dealing with this directly, do you ever hear people say, not convinced that climate change is a thing? Or is that entirely in the political realm at this point?
You know, it's funny. I've never heard farmers complain about climate change. You know, farmers see what's happening on their fields and their crops. And, you know, we've had so many of these events over really the last decade farmers know all too well that I think climate change is coming down the pike. I mean, the European heat wave in 2003, right, took a third of Europe's fruit and grain crops, you know, and also killed 50,000 people. You know, Russia, 2010, had a heat wave that took out almost half of its wheat crop, and they're one of the biggest wheat exporters in the world. Also killed 72,000 people. You know, here in the United States, we had back-to-back droughts in 2012 and 2013 that affected half of the states, cost us $30 billion. And if it weren't for federal, you know, crop insurance, you would have seen farmers driving their tractors on Washington. It was one of those things that I don't think anyone who actually makes their living from the land can deny when they're so dependent on both temperature and water.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with writer Joel Bourne about his book, The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. If you have a question, you can give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And I just want to make a note. You can meet author Joel Bourne in person at the next prologue with Ben Steelman of the Star News here at WHQR on Monday, December 14th. And you can find details about that on our website at whqr.org. That's Prologue Monday, December 14th with Ben Steelman and Joel Bourne, author of The End of Plenty. We have a question, Joel, from Jim, who writes, why are most environmental groups so focused on fossil fuel reduction, but hardly mention the meat poultry industry as a major polluter, if not the biggest polluter? Why are not more people who claim to be concerned about the environment or food scarcity becoming vegetarians and or vegans?
Well, it's a great question.
It is.
And one of the things I point up is one of the solutions that we can all do, of course, is eat less meat. You know, it takes 10 times the amount of grain to get the same calories out of a pound of beef as it does just by simply eating the grain itself. And beef especially is incredibly water intensive. So one of the solutions that that your listener mentions absolutely is to reduce our consumption of meats. Now, there are some meats that are healthy, and there are some places in the world where pastoralism actually provides wonderful protein to people who need it desperately. And these are some of the pastoral communities in Africa, in the Horn of Africa. But for us, we eat way too much. I mean, it's ridiculous how much meat the average person in the United States consume, 176 pounds a year. I think I calculate that to like a quarter pounder every day. You know, we eat some equivalent of that. Now, because of our high meat, high fat, high salt diet, half of all Americans have been projected to either have diabetes or have pre-diabetes by 2020. That's just 5 years away. And you think about the healthcare cost associated with half of a diabetic population. They're in the trillions. It's crazy. So the best thing we could do both for our environment and for public health is certainly to reduce the amount of meat that we consume. Now, in terms of, I don't pretend to speak to the environmental community. I report on the environmental community by and large. But agriculture has been given a pass. I mean, it is the largest contributor of non-point source pollution to groundwater in the country by a wide margin. There is no tailpipe they can license or regulate. And, you know, because the farm lobby is extremely powerful.
And when you say pollution, are you talking about the runoff from fertilizer?
Absolutely. It's soil, which is incredibly valuable and not replaceable in our lifetime. Fertilizer, which is causing huge dead zones. We have a dead zone off the mouth of the Mississippi every year the size of New Jersey. And that's just absolutely criminal, and that's almost all farm runoff. And, of course, groundwater pollution from the pesticides we use. We used to think, you know, Roundup was fairly benign and that it stayed in the soil. It bound fairly tightly to soil particles. But the USGS did a survey a few years ago and found either Roundup or its breakdown products in almost every water body and groundwater source in the Midwest, because we've been using it so much to grow our GMOs. So it is a problem, and certainly one that many environmental groups are now really shifting to and starting to pay attention to.
And Ed writes, what are your thoughts on the abilities of farmers in the general ag economy to rise to the challenge and produce enough to meet increased demand as they always have in the past? In a matter of only 3 or 4 years, grain supplies have gone from a little low to a huge surplus, and prices have plummeted. It seems to me that overproduction is the problem, not shortages.
Ann is exactly right. And this is what always happens. And the agronomists always say, the solution to high grain prices is high grain prices, because typically farmers will go and plow up extra land, plant the crop that's making the most money, and suddenly you've got a plethora of the grain and prices start to fall. That's the traditional supply and demand that we associate with these staple crops. What's happened, though, is since the food crisis of 2007, before then we had only three major price spikes since World War II, and all of them were typically derived by poor policy choices or severe droughts in Russia. But since 2000, we've had like four back-to-back price spikes that have had no relation to supply whatsoever. Now, what's happening now because of the surplus is because the price of oil has dropped so low, we're not using as much as for our biofuels. But the other thing driving that, you know, when corn prices were $7, $8 a bushel, the farmers in the Midwest plowed up millions upon millions of acres of some of it virgin prairie, some of it highly erodible land that was locked up in the Conservation Reserve Program, and just put all this land back into production, which we can't afford to do in the long run.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking with author Joel Bourne about his book, The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 910-343-1138 or send us an email at coastline@whqr.org. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. With me in the studio today is writer Joel Bourne. He's the author of The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, give us a call. This is our last segment, 910-343-1138. You can also send an email to coastline@whqr.org. Jeff from Oak Island, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. Did you have a question?
Well, I've been listening to the segment, and some of the information that is being offered up, as we all agree that this information is true, is very definitely refutable. And as an environmental scientist, the thing that bugs me the most is when people talk about global warming without context and the temperature changes in the environment. And we all know that there's a lot of science on both sides that refutes that. And it is not true that everyone agrees that global warming is occurring or is man-made. And I read a recent study that came out just a few days ago analyzing the last 28 years of satellite data on global temperature as measured against the temperature in space, absolute zero, or just a few degrees above that. And there is an agreement among atmospheric scientists that there is no net increase in global temperature for the last 18 years. And of that time period, about a quarter of that is the time period that the other side is saying is contributed the most to global warming because of the increase in carbon emissions. And I'd like to hear, I know your author is not necessarily a scientist, but you know, his opinion on some of the contrasting data. It's not kook science, it's real.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Jeff.
Sure, Jeff. And this is an important point because people have been worried about this for quite a long time, and it has such an enormous global significance. I was the text editor on a climate change special we did in Geographic back in 2007, 2008, around then, that really tried to lay out the basic science. And of course, we've known about the greenhouse effect since Ehringhaus and the Swedish, you know, father of chemistry back in the, 1800s. And we know that carbon is, carbon dioxide is one of the major contributors to the greenhouse effect. Now, Ehringhaus thought that was a great thing. He lived in Sweden. It was very cold. He thought all the burning of the coal was going to do great things for agriculture in Sweden. Of course, it didn't turn out that way yet, but I guess the potential is still there. But I think, you know, by and large, as a science journalist, you know, I've interviewed a lot of the people at some of our top atmospheric scientists, both here in the United States. And yes, there is dispute about various points and about the hiatus. There's dispute about where the carbon is going and where the heat is being trapped. But I think by and large, to me, as a science reporter, the scientific consensus is certainly weighing toward the fact that climate change is occurring, that we're experiencing some of the hottest years on record. And I think you can start to see, I mean, you don't have to look much farther than seeing ice melting, you know, in the glacial regions and in the tropics to be worried about what that impact is going to have. I mean, one of the slides I like to talk about that when I give a presentation is of the ice cap on the Tibetan Plateau. And of course, these are glaciers that are almost all in decline. They're expecting to have half their mass by mid-century. And yet they are the source of Asia's great rivers, you know, the Mekong, the Indus, you know, these, the Yellow and the Yangtze, these are the rivers that feed, you know, a huge amount of the world. And without that water to provide irrigation for, they're going to have a very difficult time feeding those folks. So I think the great threat that climate change and climate temperature increase poses to the world's food system is something we can't just shrug off and hope it's a decimal point. I mean, I sincerely hope you're right. I sincerely hope it would be so great, make my job so much easier if we could just say, climate change is a hoax, we don't have to worry about it. I don't think that's the case.
You're listening to Coastline, talking with writer Joel Bourne about his book, The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. Melissa from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, this is a great program. I've got to go get the book from the library. I have a comment related to the fellow who called earlier talking about how environmental groups are not interested in the agriculture pollution. Cape Fear River Watch is extremely interested in the agriculture pollution because two of our main polluters are the hog farms, and these are CAFOs, concentrated animal feeding operations, and also the chicken operations. And now I think Smithfield, we're going to have one of the biggest ever up near Fayetteville. Anyway, just want to let him know that there are groups who are very concerned about that, and some of those people are really good and can become, you know, vegetarians. I personally can't, but it is an issue that some environmental groups are extremely concerned about, particularly Cape Fear River Watch.
Thanks so much for your call, Melissa. Appreciate that.
Boy, Melissa's absolutely right. I did a story for U.S. News and Report during Hurricane Floyd and flew over some of these chicken farms and poultry farms and hog farms that got devastated during that. I know many of your long-term residents will remember what a disaster that was. And, of course, this goes back to more of a moral question as well. You know, how we raise our food is incredibly important, especially animals, both in terms of its environmental impact, but also in terms of just, you know, how we want to treat hogs.
Well, this is something, Joel Bourne, you've observed that your alma mater, NC State, has even started to change its philosophy and change its approach to agriculture and the way it looks at agronomy, the way it teaches agronomy.
Sure.
And in North Carolina, how do things need to change for us to sort of get on board with a sustainable way of farming?
Well, you know, I invite anyone who's interested in the subject to go up to the Crest Center up in outside of Goldsboro, in the old, you know, Cherry Hill Hospital farm, where they're doing wonderful work looking at the exact same topic, looking at how we can create sustainable agricultural ecosystems in eastern North Carolina particularly. And one of the most interesting things is I grew up on a farm that was very industrial, very commercial, and I watched as our quail populations plummeted due to, you know, the rise of cane cotton back in the 70s and the increase in using of pesticides. And when I visited the farm at Cherry Hill a few years ago, I saw quail everywhere. And I thought, how did you get the quail to come back? Did you plant these? And he said, you know what? As soon as we put the sprayer up, they came roaring back. And so this sort of idea of creating a farm as a healthy ecosystem is one I think that its time has come. It's harder to do. It's so much harder to do. But I think the benefits, both to the local environment, to the food that's produced, as well as to the farmer who can reap a financial benefit by growing organically, is a way that many people should turn.
And yeah. In your book, you take a look at organic farming. You went to Pennsylvania. You visited the Rodale farm operation there, which is an organic operation. And they contend that it's actually more profitable, more economically and environmentally viable, and better for human health to farm in an organic way. Why is that? How can they make that claim?
Well, there's an enormous premium paid on organic crops, right? You go to Whole Foods, you're going to pay more at your grocery bill than you are if you go to other stores, if you load your cart up with organic food. But even without the premium, organic farmers are more profitable because they don't have the enormous inputs of chemicals, fertilizer, that conventional farmers
do they
have.
Lose more crops because they can't protect them with the
there is there yes they there is more of that and there's some costs associated with soil runoff. It's very difficult for organic farmers per se to do no-till. They tend to plow their land as a form of weed control.
And tell us what no-till is.
No-till is the type of operation that you're seeing in soybeans and corn that was really sort of a specialty crop in the early 80s. But when the GMOs came on and Roundup Ready crops came on, it made it extremely easier for farmers to plant this type of crop where they don't plow the land. They just spray it with a burn-down chemical, Roundup typically, glyphosate, and then drill the seeds into the ground. So it's very little soil disturbance and very little soil runoff. It's one of the big supposed benefits of GMO crops is the reduction in soil loss.
So if Rodale can claim, for instance, that this is a better economic and environmental model, then why isn't everybody doing it?
Because it's hard to do. And it takes more management, more labor, more time. And it's not subsidized. So there's no safety net for you. And farmers, as many of you know who have friends or family who've been farmers, are very risk averse. It's one of the only occupations I know where your entire income for the year depends on whether it rains or not. And most farmers have to take out a production loan in the beginning of the year that they have to pay back at the end of the year, or they lose the farm. So it's a very risk-averse business. Whether you're talking North Carolina or the Punjab of India, it's the same.
You're listening to Coastline. We have writer Joel Bourne, the author of The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. Paul, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Yes, I would like to make a comment that counters the climate change denier you had just a few minutes ago. Whether or not the climate changes, all food production on this planet is absolutely, except for organic, of course, is absolutely dependent upon fossil fuels. And whether you burn coal or petroleum or natural gas or methane class rates, what have you, there's a finite amount of carbon on this planet that we can burn up. When that's gone, food production will collapse.
No. Paul, you're very right. I mean, the vast majority of nitrogen fertilizer in the world today is made through the Haber-Bosch process, and natural gas is the primary feedstock for that. Now, unfortunately, you know, I wrote some stories about peak oil back in the 70s before the fracking boom, and it seems like every time, you know, we've run out of cheap oil, but even not now because we've all, you know, oil is as cheap as it's been since the 80s. So every time we think we're running out, we find more of it. And I've just come back from the Arctic where I've reported on several huge oil fields up there. So unfortunately, I think we're awash in oil. We're going to have to do something else to wean ourselves off.
Paul, thanks so much for your call. You visited some interesting farming places throughout the course of your putting this book together. You went to the desert in the southwest of the United States. So if we talk about how much water it takes to grow crops, it seems hard to believe that we could look at the desert as potentially arable land, is it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Central Valley and the Imperial Valley, where we get most of our salad crops, are technically deserts. I mean, it's the Imperial Valley down where I spent most of my time outside of San Diego in the Salton Sea area. It's part of the Northern Sonoran Desert. It gets 2 to 3 inches of rain a year. The only thing that makes that place green is the Colorado River. And in the Central Valley, the only thing that keeps them green is snowmelt from the Sierra Nevada, both of which are over-appropriated and in great decline over the last few years. So these are some of the areas. If you think about it, you know, according to the estimates, we currently have, in 2012, 2 billion people lived in areas that suffered from water stress or scarcity. And in two decades, that number is supposed to rise to 3.6 billion based on population growth and whatnot. So really, that's half the current population of the Earth will live where water is scarce. So we have to manage our water better. According to the World Bank, water demand is going to increase 70 to 90% by 2050. But they also recognize that the water doesn't exist to fill that demand. So in order for us to get from here to there, we're going to have to use it smarter. And there are many ways to do it. I mean, our current irrigation system is only 50% efficient. We basically, just like our food system, we waste half our water growing our crops. You know, and even in California's drought situation now with all the regulations, they still have a lot of swimming pools out there that are sparkly and blue. Right. So there are many ways we can reduce our water use. And I think we will, because food is going to be far more important than luxuries.
At this conference that I referenced that occurred last night, Tuesday night in Charlotte, sponsored by the Charlotte Observer, looking at America's water supply, I think one of the panelists said future generations will think that we're crazy for watering our lawns with potable drinking water. And he was talking about the southeastern part of this country.
Yes, absolutely. And if you think about it, one of the interesting things that I saw sort of how far we've fallen, I visited they call it the groundwater replenishment plant, which is sort of a euphemism. It's a multi-billion dollar reverse osmosis facility in Orange County, right outside of the old Disney World. And basically, they use it to take the liquids out of Orange County sewer and recycle it into potable drinking water, which they then put back in the ground to dissolve the ick factor, even though it's almost purely, you know, potable by the time they're finished running it through the filters. But they put it in the ground so people won't think it's coming out of the toilet, and then they pump it back up 6 months later. And it's been so successful that they've just voted another billion-dollar bond or several million-dollar bond issue to expand the capacity of the plant because they've had such difficult time getting water from L.A. and the Metropolitan Water District and from the Colorado River.
One of the other potential sources for food production is the ocean. And we're seeing all these marine fish farms happening, and people walk into grocery stores and see, you know, packages of fish that say farm raised.
Sure.
And there's controversy around that. But you went to visit a guy who is farming in the open ocean, but it's not yet profitable. Can you tell us about that operation?
Well, this is what I think is one of the true potential success stories, to grow an enormous amount of protein with very little impact on the planet. Now, most people hold their nose when they think about farmed fish, and we think about salmon and all the pesticides and problems that the salmon industry has caused, the disease, and we think about shrimp, the two of the biggest farm species that we eat, and the fact that, you know, the shrimp farms took out a bunch of mangroves in Latin America when we helped establish them. The USAID went down there and helped them put in shrimp farms. But there are now many types of aquaculture that are incredibly sustainable. And one of these programs that you mentioned was off the coast of Panama. So I went and visited this young entrepreneur from New York who went down to Panama and took over an old fish hatchery, is now growing cobia, which some of your listeners who like to fish will realize that that's a fish that we catch off the coast of North Carolina. Delicious white meat, as much as omega-3 as salmon, omega-3 fatty acids. It's incredibly healthy. And, you know, most aquaculture operations are in protected waters where you can watch your fish and they're protected from storms. And that was what kind of causes the problem, because typically those areas are sheltered. They don't have much exchange of water.
The waste builds up.
The waste builds up on the bottom. It's a real pain. He's doing it in the open ocean like Jacques Cousteau envisioned, 8 miles offshore off the Panama Shelf. And they haven't detected any noticeable pollution outside the pens. And he's going great guns.
And we've just scratched the surface of some of the possibilities that you've written about in The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. Thanks for joining us today, Joel Bourne.
Rachel, it's been a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Thanks to all of you who called and emailed to join the conversation. And join us Monday, December 14th, right here in the MC Ernie Gallery at WHQR. It's Prologue with Ben Steelman and author Joel Bourne. They'll be talking about his book, and you'll have a chance to meet him in person. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Our producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. If you missed part of today's show, look for it on our website at WHQR.org or subscribe to the podcast from the iTunes Store. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.